for argument in Courier versus Sutherland, and we're ready to hear from the petitioner.
May it please the court, my name is Andrew Rosen. I represent David Courier, Heather Schultz, the bicyclists who were struck by a motor vehicle operated by Eloy Lopez as he was turning left into a liquor store while he was under the influence of alcohol. Primary issue to be decided by the court is what was the legislature's intent in adopting the current version of the remedial revival statute as it existed when it was adopted in 1986. There is, in fact, a secondary issue here, and that's why we have amicus curiae briefs. That is, what are we going to do in the future? I'm prepared to argue that if there are any questions with respect to that, but I'm here representing people that wish their rights to be protected, and that's going to be the focus of my argument this morning. A brief history of the case is that after this collision occurred, my clients did contact State Farm Insurance and, in fact, were compensated for their property damage, but left open the issue of their personal injury damages. Once they were able to determine the extent of those injuries, which involved some surgeries, they commenced the suit within the statute of limitations. Unbeknownst to them, Mr. Lopez had died approximately 8 months before they filed the suit. But one of the key facts which he shouldn't lose sight of is that at that time, no estate had been opened, nor had a personal representative been appointed in order to administer their claim. When counsel in this case learned of that fact, he attempted to do what he thought was the best way to get this case to move forward. But ultimately, the case was dismissed because at the time the suit was filed, and no personal representative having been appointed, it was impossible for him to have given notice to the personal representative because he didn't exist. Fundamental point, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that if Mr. Lopez was alive at the time the suit was filed, we wouldn't be here today. It would be a very easy issue. Had he died subsequent to the filing of the lawsuit, there is a procedure in the statute talks about how that's to be dealt with. But what we have here is, what does it mean when somebody dies, a defendant dies before a suit is filed? And so it's an issue of statutory construction. I'm not going to restate all the rules of statutory construction. In fact, this court in the last month has issued two opinions. One, the Summers case, in which Justice Rice wrote the opinion, and the other, the Union Pacific case, which Justice Coates wrote the opinion, and went into extensive discussions about how we do statutory construction. But I did think it was demonstrative of a statement, Justice Rice, that you made in that case. You said, we are mindful that a statute should not be construed in a manner which defeats the obvious legislative intent. The question here is, what did the legislature intend when it adopted the remedial revival statute? What it intended to do was not to create the harsh results which occur when somebody tries to do the right thing, files the timely lawsuit, but then through circumstances beyond their control is not able to fix the problem. Based upon the facts as they exist in this case, there's really two guiding principles that I think underlie what the issue is before the court. One is, the legislature has expressed an intent that people who are injured in automobile accidents should be compensated. We can see that two ways. First, the insurance requirement. And second, the fact that we have a 3-year statute of limitations with respect to motor vehicle negligence. We only have a 2-year statute of limitations with respect to others. So we see that the legislature wants people to be compensated when they're injured in motor vehicle accidents through the fault of another. Furthermore, this court has a policy, and all courts of appeal seem to follow that same policy, which is that disputes and ought to be resolved on their merits. Thus, if you follow our position with respect to how this statute applies, it is consistent with those two principles. However, if you choose to follow what the defendants argue in this case, which is a very narrow, strict interpretation of this statute, then you're going to defeat those two purposes that underlie what is occurring here. I think that what's really helpful is a statement that was made by the Court of Appeals in a case of Sharp Brothers Contracting, and was quoting from a case called Soner versus Soner, and they're both cited in my brief. And what the court said there was section 1381.11, which is the statute you're here to interpret, and reflects a legislative intent to enable litigants to avoid the hardships which might result from strict adherence to the provisions of the statutes of limitations. The fact is here that we have, on one side, the plaintiffs who tried to do the right thing.
Mr. Rosen?
Yes.
I just asked you a question about, since you mentioned the Sharp case, Sharp Brothers case. It seemed to me, and maybe this is incorrect, that case held that the revival statute only applies against the defendants named in the original complaint. And why shouldn't that holding preclude here the use of the revival statute?
Because it really is the same defendant. The fact is that you cannot sue a dead person. What you're doing is the law has created what I would call a legal fiction. That legal fiction is that although Sutherland is a different name, he really steps into the shoes of Mr. Lopez, because Mr. Lopez is no longer alive. Because he's no longer alive, there is no case or controversy. In order to create the case or controversy, one must name somebody that does have the ability to defend, but really, we're still suing Mr. Lopez. That's my answer to how Sharp Brothers doesn't apply in the facts of this case.
Well, I assume the only asset Mr. Lopez has would be the insurance proceeds. What else is involved?
At this point, as we've stated in our brief and is in the motion for summary judgment in a footnote, we're not seeking more than the insurance coverage. We're not there to determine whether or not, in fact, there are other assets to go after. We're not technically going after those and people that may have inherited. We're strictly going on the limits of the particular policy.
Well, was there no estate opened or any other way to?
That's the problem. There was no estate that was ever opened, and that's what I think shifts the burden or shifts the concept of how we need to look at this. State Farm and the heirs of Mr. Lopez had the opportunity to open an estate. They knew that there was this claim sitting out there. Yet they chose not to open that estate, not to have a personal representative appointed, and thus put my clients in this unique box.
Well, isn't there any procedure available to name or try to go after the policy itself? I know generally you can't sue the insurance company, but it would seem in a circumstance like this, you ought to be able to get some kind of rem the proceeds and institute a proceeding. There's nothing like that?
The only thing that I can say is that, to my knowledge, that we've gotten into all these cases with respect to service of process in terms of how do you serve, and is it quasi in rem, is it in rem, is it a personal claim, and the courts have universally held that no, you can't get there that way. So, unfortunately, no. As it stands now, the rules of due process have rendered decisions that have come out primarily the Court of Appeals within the last several years, which say, no, you can't do it. The only way to do it is you have to sue the defendant, the wrongdoer. In this case, the wrongdoer is dead. There is no personal representative. Which brings me to a very important point, and that is, all we're asking is that the statute be applied to a very unique circumstance, very specific. I won't say unique because, in fact, We've been contacted about another similar situation which has occurred. But it is a specific circumstance. All we're saying is that the statute does apply when there are two conditions. One, where the defendant has died prior to the filing of the suit, and two, where no estate was ever opened.
Can you relate your argument to the language of the statute? I mean, I gather what you're saying is that your particular circumstances here constitute lack of jurisdiction or improper venue.
Correct. And that is when you sue a dead person, the case law that was in existence at the time that the statute was passed was the Jenkins case. The Jenkins case said, when you sue a dead person, the court has no subject matter jurisdiction. That was the law that the court, that the legislature understood was the law when it used the word jurisdiction.
And you say that the legislature understood that because of the timing?
Because of the timing, number one. Number two, the rule of statutory construction that says they are presumed to know what the courts have done in terms of precedent. Because in this particular case, unfortunately, I think we'd all be happy if I could have gone to the revisor of statutes and gone into the archives and found legislative intent and looked at the committee comments. The fact is they don't exist. So we have to go to that rule that says this court must presume that at the time that the statute was adopted, it understood that it was jurisdictional. And therefore, the use of the word jurisdiction fits the circumstances of this case. Does it apply in other situations? Maybe. But I'm not here to argue that today. All I'm here to argue is that under these specific facts, the statute does apply. Because it makes no sense for it not to apply.
Well, counsel, can I stop you there? Do you, you're basically, I understand your statutory argument. You're saying when the legislature passed or used the word jurisdiction, it understood that we had used the word jurisdiction in a particular sort of way, in the way to cover your case. I'm wondering if you could extrapolate from that, though. Do you think that it's actually correct that the use of the word jurisdiction covers your situation, or is the word capacity more correct today? I'm wondering if you could tell me, I mean, in other words, are you asking us to freeze the statute, I guess, under a particular understanding of the word jurisdiction that may have changed?
No, I'm not asking that at all. As a matter of fact, that's why I divide it into two issues. The issue that I'm talking about is how do we apply it to this person, my clients, and this circumstance. And I'm happy to address that issue. And that's why CTLA filed a brief, and that's why CDLA filed a brief. In my opinion, I think that, in fact, the better rule is that if, in fact, the court has used the word jurisdiction, and now this court chooses to adopt the capacity standard, that it's then up to the legislature to amend the statute to change the word. But until this court changes that and adopts what Judge Davidson said is now the test, because even Judge Davidson, in her opinion, admits that since Jenkins, there has not been a single decision that has come out of the Court of Appeals that has addressed the issue of jurisdiction versus capacity. So the first time we have capacity being the word to be used in the context that we have here is Judge Davidson's opinion. And that's not fair that my clients are going to have to now go back or suffer from the fact that now, under a modern theory, we want to use the word capacity, and therefore my clients are the ones that have to suffer because at the time they filed their lawsuit, the word was jurisdiction. So that's my position with respect to that.
Thank you.
This time I will reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
May it please the court, Gary Palumbo for the respondent. The petitioner's claim in this case, based on Jenkins, that the trial court had no subject matter jurisdiction over the original complaint because the action named a non-existent person, and as such, the action was void at the onset. And they claim that was the law at the time. To the contrary, the law long in existence in Colorado, and beginning with the Colorado Constitution, is demonstrated by cases such as Funk in 1924, Barker in 1980. And those cases tell us that when dealing with capacity issues, including non-existent parties, those cases do not impair the ability of the court to proceed. We're not dealing with a situation that's void at the onset. In the Funk case, this court explicitly said the capacity issues do not implicate jurisdiction. That's 1924. It's not like this is a new concept. It's not a subject matter jurisdiction issue. Capacity deficiencies are within the court's power, the trial court's power, to correct by using Rule 15 and to amend. In Barker, this court explicitly invited the parties, or suggested that the parties should have used Rule 15 to amend the pleadings in a situation where there was a non-existent party named as a defendant.
Mr. Palumbo, I just asked this as a question. The Barker case, the most recent case, and you're right about footnote 4, but does that make any difference that it was a business that we're talking about, or corporation?
To the extent that it's a non-existent party, I don't think so. I think the issue the court framed for us is with regard to non-existent parties, and it would be the same conclusion that you would have a void action when you're proceeding against a non-existent party would be the plaintiff's take on that.
So play this out. What should they have done, and what would the result have been?
In this particular case?
Yes.
I don't think the remedial revival statute provides a remedy for
this. But what was the alternative, though, they were suggesting?
The alternative is to file the action sooner and give oneself time to learn. I mean, litigation requires preparation. And Rule 11 tells us that. This case was filed 4 days before the statute of limitations expired.
So it should have been filed when, under your theory?
Well, there's choices made. I mean, the choice was made to wait until 4 days before.
Well, they could have filed an amended complaint, right? And that would have got them in the statute. But here, there is no defendant.
Well, if they filed an amended complaint...
Couldn't comply with Rule 15, right?
Well, if they filed an amended complaint after the statute of limitations expired, the DeFelice case would tell us that they're not going to get relation back, and it would be subject to a statute of limitations defense. Should that defense be raised?
If they'd done it beforehand, could they have done? Would the rule apply?
If they had used Rule 15
and amended within
before the statute of limitations expired, they'd be in court. There'd be no problem.
But who would they have named?
The estate of Eloy Lopez.
Under the amended complaint. Did the estate exist?
They would create the estate. The statute exists that allows them, if they have a claim against the deceased, to themselves create an estate and then sue that estate. That's what needed to occur. And that needed to occur before the statute of limitations expired. Because the relation back argument, the relation back provision of Rule 16 will only work if the new defendant knew about the action within the limitations period. Here, where we're dealing with an estate, that person, in effect, was not born or would not be born until it's created by the plaintiff seeking to create an estate. So they have to create that person, that legal person, before the statute of limitations expires. Otherwise, Rule 15 is not going to allow them.
Yeah, this would apply to every circumstance that there is a defendant person who dies sometime during the statute of limitations, after the lawsuit is commenced, even under your theory, right? Am I following this right?
Before.
I mean, you'd have to amend. You'd have to be on constant notice about whether the person is alive or not.
Before you commence the lawsuit. After you commence the lawsuit, you're in Rule 25.
But you have to create the estate if he dies sometime during that running.
Correct. But after the lawsuit is... We're not talking about a situation... If you serve a live person and you commence, you know, you're doing discovery or whatever, and then that person dies, Rule 25 tells us that you can bring in the estate at that point. You're not in statute of limitations concerns at that state. This only applies where you have filed the action, the statute of limitations expires, you learn that you need to have an estate as the defendant. You create the estate and then serve the estate. You cannot relate that back to the filing before the statute of limitations. So it's subject to a statute of limitations defense by the defendant, which would be granted. That's what happened in the DeFelice case.
Okay.
Correct. So here, the Colorado Constitution is what tells us about subject matter jurisdiction issues, and clearly the district court had subject matter jurisdiction over this tort case. Questions of identity and capacity may implicate personal jurisdiction, but the court is not powerless to affect those issues. It has subject matter jurisdiction, and it can deal with it. And all of these cases, Jenkins, Ivanhoe, Barker, are all cases of deficient capacity, regardless of the words that the court is using to describe the situation. None of them implicate the power of the court to act as granted by the Colorado Constitution, and as explicitly stated by this court in Barker, the court has the power to act under Rule 15, power that it would not have if this was a subject matter jurisdiction problem.
Counsel, can I stop you there, though?
Yes.
I mean, you do admit that the words subject matter jurisdiction were used, and I guess I'm curious, how does that connect up, in your view, with the legislature's understanding of the use of the word jurisdiction?
Well, I have to assume the legislature is aware of the Constitution. I have to assume they're aware of the Funk case.
But what if we're using the word inappropriately, or courts are using the word inappropriately? Are they not entitled to rely on that?
Well, in this particular instance, the Jenkins case occurred after the modern iteration of this statute went into effect. The statute went into effect in 1971. I think Jenkins was a 1980 case. And, you know, we in 1971, we had the Rules of Civil Procedure. They'd just been enacted, and Rule 15, and, you know, the Colorado Constitution, of course, there was there a long, long time. And I think the Funk case would have been, if they were looking at this and thinking of it at all, they would have been looking at that. They didn't have the Jenkins case to look at.
Well, I'll put it a little differently then. If courts use the term somewhat inartfully, how do you expect the General Assembly to use it more artfully?
Well, I guess I expect them to be aware of all of it. If we're going to assume that they're aware of the law, I'm going to expect them to be aware of all of it. And it's not like this Jenkins case was clear issue. There have been conflicting cases on how the appellate courts of this state talk about this issue of capacity throughout the 20th century. In many cases, I mean, we have capacity, we have personal jurisdiction being discussed, we have subject matter jurisdiction discussed. Most of the times, we have jurisdiction being discussed without a clear run through of the civil procedure distinctions between personal and subject matter jurisdiction. So it's been rather loosely discussed out there, and Jenkins is, I think if all of the jurisprudence is reviewed, it's not a beacon of what, there is no inconsistencies involved.
Okay, thank you.
The problem for the plaintiff's argument, aside from the fact that Jenkins is at odds with other cases existing at the time, is that this resulting nullification of the original complaint would leave nothing for the trial court to, quote, terminate within the meaning of the remedial revival statute. So now if we turn to the language of that statute, it requires that a case be terminated by the district court for jurisdictional reasons or venue reasons. If the case is a nullity and it never existed, and the court has no power to act, there's nothing which can be terminated. The remedial revival statute requires initially that an action exist within the statute of limitations period. If the plaintiff's original action was a nullity, there was no action filed, There was nothing to terminate, and there's nothing to which the remedial revival statute can apply. The Court of Appeals did not defeat any legislative intent here by declining to permit the use of the remedial revival statute to permit a new action against a new defendant. The remedy the petitioner wants here is indeed to bring a new action against a new party. The remedial revival statute, however, exists to allow a new action on the same cause of action, and the estate submits that a proposed action against the estate of Eli Lopez is not the same cause of action as the original action they filed against Mr. Lopez. Cause of action against a different defendant is necessarily a different cause of action. And this conclusion is confirmed by this court's, by the Court of Appeals decision in the Sharp Brothers case. There, the court held that the remedial revival statute will only apply to revive claims that were made against defendants that were sued within the statute of limitations. With that recognition, the remedial revival statute is properly seen as a vehicle to correct the situation where, due to subject matter jurisdiction, personal jurisdiction, or venue issues, the complaint as written with the parties as designated is in the wrong court. And the remedial revival statute lets it be moved as a new action to a new court, even if the statute of limitations has expired. The remedial revival statute has never been used in Colorado to permit a plaintiff to stay in the same court but bring in a new case against new defendants against whom the action is time barred. It never has happened. Rule 15C is the remedy for situations where the plaintiff has named the wrong parties. The remedial revival statute is the remedy for situations where the plaintiff has the right parties, but he's got them in the wrong court. The remedial revival statute explicitly allows only that remedy, taking the original complaint, namely the same cause of action, and putting it in a different court in a new cause of action. The proposed use of the remedial revival statute by the plaintiffs here to add new parties is not authorized by the language of the statute or any Colorado case. Next, the evolution of the remedial revival statute in Colorado through its various iterations demonstrates that the current statute was not intended to remedy a situation where the plaintiff files an action and learns after the statute expires, statute of limitations expires, that the defendant is dead. In the 1908 remedial revival statute, the legislature explicitly permitted revival if the original action was defeated by the death of the party. Was a specific term in that iteration of the statute. But the current language, which first was enacted in 1971, in that statute, this death predicate is absent. And only termination of the action due to jurisdiction or venue will trigger the statutory remedy. The current statute does
could
not...
Could I just interrupt you?
Yes.
What in your opinion, is the difference between capacity and personal jurisdiction?
Well, they can be in the same. I think personal capacity can be an issue of personal jurisdiction.
What is the difference?
The court cannot enter a judgment or compel action by one who does not have capacity.
So capacity is, and how is capacity distinct from personal jurisdiction?
So
the court, it's the same thing. So are we really just talking about personal jurisdiction? You can't have
personal jurisdiction issues that don't involve capacity.
Well, what is capacity then?
Capacity is the ability to be sued, to be a live person, a competent person, a person of 18 years.
So if you're dead, the court can't have personal jurisdiction. There cannot be personal jurisdiction.
Correct. And that's corrected by Rule 15. You come in, court has subject matter jurisdiction.
I mean, capacity could mean something different in other contexts, but here that's really all it means. Isn't that right?
I don't disagree with that.
You don't? I'm sorry.
I don't. I think that's our brief states as much.
Yeah. So the statute says subject matter jurisdiction, And you and I are now kind of...
The statute says jurisdiction. I think it allows either, it doesn't...
Because of lack of jurisdiction, you're right, or improper venue.
Correct.
So if we're really talking about jurisdiction, personal subject matter, why...
This case was not terminated for a lack of personal jurisdiction.
But...
The plaintiff came in...
We are agreeing that there's no capacity here, which is the same as personal jurisdiction.
Right. The plaintiff corrected that in this, in our facts. The plaintiff corrected that deficiency by filing an amended complaint, as properly they should under Rule 15. They corrected that.
Well, let's just go through the steps. The case was filed against the deceased. You and I agree that the court had no personal jurisdiction.
Correct.
Statute of limitations ran.
Correct.
Next thing that happened was an estate was created. A motion was filed to allow for an amended complaint. The amended complaint was filed.
Correct.
The next thing that happened was a motion to dismiss. The amended complaint doesn't relate back.
Correct. Motion for summary judgment.
Motion for summary judgment doesn't Correct. Relate back.
Correct.
Okay, now the statute says if it's dismissed because of... of lack of jurisdiction. You say it doesn't relate back because the court didn't have jurisdiction over the dead person.
But the complaint the court was looking at that juncture, it had jurisdiction over that complaint. The dead
subject
person
matter,
no longer there.
Subject matter jurisdiction.
And personal jurisdiction because the defendant...
How can it have personal jurisdiction if the person was dead?
Because the defendant in the amended complaint is not the deceased. The defendant in the amended complaint is the estate. And the court has personal jurisdiction over the estate. The original complaint is gone. It's superseded.
It's gone because of a lack of jurisdiction.
No, it's gone because it was amended under Rule 15. And the amendment makes the first complaint superseded. So when the court is sitting there ruling on the motion for summary judgment, it has a complaint before it over which it has both
let's just run the language. If an action is commenced within the period allowed by this article, and it was,
yes,
and is terminated because of lack of jurisdiction, it's terminated because of a lack of personal jurisdiction, the plaintiff may commence a new action, which he did, on the same cause of action, which he did, within 90 days, which he did. Now, you're saying it's not the same cause of action because it's a different defendant. It is the same cause of action, it's just a different defendant. There's different personal jurisdiction.
The remedial revival statute didn't get invoked in any time in this proceeding. What happened in this proceeding is there was an original complaint. The plaintiff moved to amend it under Rule 15. Then there was a summary judgment, and the court ruled on the summary judgment in reference to the amended complaint.
The court ruled that there was no relation back.
Correct.
And why? Why was there no relation back?
Because the new party over whom it has personal jurisdiction did not have notice of the lawsuit within the limitation period.
You're saying as a matter of law, he couldn't have notice because he didn't exist.
That's correct. If a plaintiff is going to wait until the last minute and not check the death records in the county, there is indeed not a remedy in this situation. They've made some choices here. And those choices are visited on the plaintiff in this scheme, not on the defendant or his successors. That is correct. I mean, and this is what I was going to, talking about the statutory language. If the at one point in time, it was in our remedial revival statute that the death of a party triggered the applicability of the statute. And that was taken out. I mean, when the legislature reenacted the statute in 1971, they could well have said jurisdiction, venue, and the death of a party.
Well, I'm not so sure because they got the death of a party in here. It's just rephrased. Of course, you're going to say that's a rephrasing that doesn't, that shows some kind of substantive change over the original statute.
Your Honor is talking about the fact that the personal jurisdiction issue.
Yeah,
I mean, the...
But this hardly seems like a remedial statute, because you're supposed to be able to have the full limitation period to research your facts, make sure you have a valid cause, et cetera, et cetera. You know?
But it applies only when you have the same parties. I mean, you've got to have the same cause of action. That means the same...
Well, that's because you say it does.
And the same defense.
But the cause of action is the same. The personal injury responsibility for this occurrence that occurred when the deceased was alive, and for which there has been some sort of action taken, you know, under the law that allows personal injury plaintiffs to bring their cause within a statute of limitation period. Now, the cause of action was brought, but somehow the remedy doesn't do what begs to be done, let's say, under facts like this. What about a missing in action soldier or something like this?
A soldier and sailor.
He's dead?
Well, I think there's a soldier and sailor.
Okay, takes care of that. Let's say an outward bound instructor lost at sea. Is the person dead or alive?
I'm not an expert on that, but I think for all purposes, at some point in time after somebody's declared dead, that can be relied on by other parties. Honestly, I don't know what happens when someone is resurrected. That would be something I haven't looked at.
Well, okay.
Probably maybe some other feature of the law other than this statute would be involved there. But I mean, the Sharp Brothers case is just a perfect example of talking about a situation where this was just not meant to expand the list of defendants. There's nothing in the history of this statute in its application or its language that tells us we can pull a new defendant into the case. And even, you know, counsel can say that it's just the same as the defendant, but it's not in any way just the same as the defendant. It's a different person, and just as different as his brother would be from him, or his wife or his children. They are different people. The claim is against the defendant, and the remedy is to substitute the estate under Rule 15, and it has to be done in a timely manner. The records, you know, our Colorado statutes provide for death certificates to be filed with the county within a few days of the time somebody has died. It's not like these are impossible tasks. These are knowable facts, and one of many that people have to check out as they are considering the filing of a lawsuit. So I do not see this as a harsh circumstances. It's just one more fact to be known among many. To comply with Rule 11 and other rules as a person decides to file a lawsuit. So in this case, we had the court had before it an amended complaint. It had jurisdiction over the defendant and over the subject matter, and it ruled on the summary judgment motion before it properly because there was no relation back of the complaint to the new estate. Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm glad that we get in that Mr. Palumbo claims that my clients had a duty to determine whether or not Mr. Lopez had died or not. We have a statutory scheme to protect creditors, put them on notice when somebody has died, and that's the Uniform Probate Code. Uniform Probate Code says if you want to eliminate creditors, you need to tell them that the person died. You open an estate, you have a personal representative appointed, and then they're on notice. What they want to argue is that my clients needed to go down to the county coroner's office in Minturn, Colorado, every day to check whether or not there was a death certificate. That's outrageous. It was their burden, if anybody had a burden, in order to avoid the possibility of what happened here, for them to have opened the estate in a timely fashion, had a personal representative appointed. If that had occurred, they would have had to have given written notice to my clients because they knew of the existence of their them as creditors, and we wouldn't be here today. So that's
how did they know? Excuse me. How did they know of the existence of your client as a creditor? I understood that they
State Farm was notified about the claim the day, or within a matter
of
days.
Was State Farm under the impression that it had been settled since they dealt with the property aspect, or
no?
Was it
they knew
open?
They were, they,
was it
they
an
tried
open claim?
To settle the personal injury case,
was,
but it wasn't settled.
Was it an open claim?
Yes.
But State Farm, when did the State Farm, if the record shows, become aware that their insured had died?
That's not in the record. But first of all, let me correct a historical error. The statute went into effect in 1986. The prior statute, which was adopted in 1971, was specifically repealed by the legislature. There was no statute of remedial statute in existence as of 1986. It was in 1986 when that statute that currently exists was the one that was adopted, and that was at a point in time when Jenkins was the law. Jenkins talks directly to this particular fact situation with dead people and estates. The Funk case from way back when doesn't talk about this at all. Furthermore, interestingly enough...
Excuse me, as I understood your opposing counsel, he said that an earlier version of this statute specifically addressed the people who died. Is that correct?
That is correct. And in the brief, I go through a history. First of all, we have to go back to English law. Where
no,
there was law, but the first 1908.
Let's keep this focused. So as of
1908, the court comes, or the legislature says, if somebody dies, the revival statute applies.
And that's in on the books until when?
Until 1963.
63.
And then it was amended in 63, and then it was adopted again in 73, I believe, and then it was repealed. And there was no remedial statute. Then the legislature, for whatever reason, in 1986, adopts the current version of what the statute is today.
And it doesn't include dead person.
It eliminated the word dead person, and for a good reason, because it says there can be other situations, not just dead people, where we want people to be able to revive it. And I'll give you a classic example. Let's assume hypothetically that a plaintiff filed a suit in federal district court thinking that it had diversity jurisdiction. And in fact, it ends up that it's not diversity jurisdiction for either the fact that the person had moved into the state of Colorado, or you couldn't show that there was at least $75,000 in damages. That case gets terminated on jurisdictional grounds. And that person then has the right to go back to court within 90 days in Colorado to file the lawsuit against the right person or in the right court. Just so happens in this case, we have the courts that because the cause of action accrued in the same county, it's filed again in the same jurisdiction. Jurisdiction being a different word context than what's used in the statute.
Do you agree that capacity and personal jurisdiction are the same?
Yes. But what you have to, what's interesting is one of the cases that is cited by CDLA in this, in their amicus brief, is very instructive, and it's the SMLL case. And what the SMLL case is dealing with the plaintiff's side, whether the plaintiff has the right to bring the case or not bring the case. In that case, the plaintiff in fact existed, but did not have the capacity to sue because it was not registered properly with the Colorado Secretary of State. What the court said in that case was, thus, unlike a lack of standing, which means there is no justiciable controversy and hence no basis for the court's exercise of jurisdiction, a lack of capacity does not affect the court's subject matter jurisdiction. What we have is they want a narrow interpretation of what subject matter jurisdiction means, and Justice and Judge Davidson made the same mistake. In addition to saying that you have the right to sue somebody in a Colorado court under a particular statute, there has to be a justiciable issue that requires a case or controversy. If there is not a party on both sides, there is no justiciability, and there is no subject matter jurisdiction, because there is no case or controversy. Thus, when they sued a dead person, there could not be a case or controversy. Case or controversy is subject matter jurisdiction.
Let me switch. I'll have just a different question just to move you around a bit. What do you say about just the fact that it's a legal impossibility to have the estate who didn't exist yet have notice, even though it seems State Farm did know that this claim was pending?
If I were going to argue that, I would say Rule 15C ought to be liberally construed to say in that particular circumstance, DeFelice is wrong.
We'd have to overrule.
Should be reversed and overruled. Because in a situation where a party does not exist, it's impossible to comply with Rule 15C. 15C contemplates the fact that the person did exist at a time when the statute of limitations had not run. So you can reach the same result, if you want to, by simply saying DeFelice is wrong, overrule DeFelice, and say in the circumstance in which a party did not even exist, Rule 15C can't apply in that circumstance, and you do have the right to relate back under the equitable powers of the court to do so, irrespective of the literal language of the rule. But I don't believe that's the way this decision ought to be made. I believe that this statute was adopted with a broad use of the word jurisdiction at a time when a case existed, which specifically said under these circumstances, the court is without subject matter.
Mr. Rosen, can I interrupt you there? I just want to get straightened out on the statute and the language here then. So you are reading the word in the statute, jurisdiction, to mean subject matter jurisdiction.
No, it also means personal jurisdiction. But then once we go to the personal jurisdiction, then I have to deal with Mr. Palumbo's argument about, well, did we fix it by amending the complaint? And because we amended the complaint, are we going to punish these defendants
Does that suggest then, if you had just used a different tactic and you had asked and you had asked for dismissal on the grounds of lack of subject matter jurisdiction rather than amending the complaint, that you would have been fine?
That's an interesting question. And the answer is yes and no. I'd like to give you a yes and no answer. And the reason why is because if you read the title of what the subject is, the title of the statute is involuntary dismissal. And so now, if you go into the court and you say, Judge, I want to dismiss this case because the person's dead, then do I have to come before you and argue that because it's now a voluntary
dismissal? Okay, suppose you say, I want to proceed with the case, and you wait for the other side to say you can't if the guy's dead.
There's nobody on the other side. To say that.
Okay.
That's the problem.
So okay. Let me ask you one. Okay, sure. We'll take all that up to that point. Let me ask you one question about your statutory construction and legislative intent part. You're relying on case law from Court of Appeals to indicate what the legislature would have been aware of, the
correct
particular definition there. Now, remind me about the timing of this again.
The statute which is in question here was a brand new statute which went into effect in 1986. Prior to 1986, for a period of I can't remember how many years, there was no remedial revival statute.
I appreciate that. So then when was the language that you think the legislature had been relying on? When did that come into
effect? Jenkins' existence? Opinion, I believe, is 1980.
I thought it was 1990.
I'm sorry. I thought it was. Nope. Oh, it is 1990. That's correct. Question being, though, once the court then comes out and says, this is the test, if the legislature believes that it didn't want it to apply in that circumstance, then it would change the rule. It would change the statute.
Okay.
There was, in fact, I believe, and also a subsequent change which went from 1 year to 90 days. That the 1986 version, if I'm correct, was a one-year statute. They then changed the statute to make it a 90-day provision.
So you weren't relying on a trial court ruling or the fact that the case had been filed before 1986 or anything like that. You're saying the language of 1990 shows the legislature would have amended the statute had they intended something different.
Sure, and I apologize, that was my mistake. In fact, the original statute that was adopted in 1996 was in fact a one-year provision, and then subsequent to that time, they then went to 90 days, which still continued to use the word jurisdiction. So yes, when the statute was originally adopted in 1986, that's correct, Jenkins had not come out. But there is other case law, which is cited in our brief, in which talks about this concept of subject matter jurisdiction, which did predate the 1986 adoption of this case. So it's not Jenkins that necessarily controls.
Tell me what you want us to do again. You want us to make prospective this capacity argument as of our opinion?
If I think that either you can say we're now going to use the modern term of capacity, but it's only effective prospectively, doesn't apply to these people, because we didn't have a case, as I said, just Judge Davidson admitted that there hasn't been any change in the law up until basically 2005, when they started talking about this issue again, 2004, 2005, and the SMLL case and the Atkin, there's another case that came about. So my position is no. I think that in this particular circumstance, again, where the person is dead and no estate has been opened, the question is subject matter jurisdiction. What you choose to do with respect to the fact of a estate had been opened, then you get into this defelice argument and you get into this 15C argument, because we now take a look at the Jenkins case, which then talks in terms of, and the defelice case, where in fact the estate was closed at the time the suit was then filed, and got into this whole complex. My position is that that the statute as it currently existed in 2005 when the suit was filed, covered this particular fact situation. That is, where the defendant is dead, no personal representative has been appointed, no estate has ever been opened, this statute covers that fact circumstance.
Could I ask one more, just for my curiosity, sort of historical? This is so strange in the way this whole thing got started. So how did you all acquire personal jurisdiction over the defendant?
We never did. He's dead.
How did you think you acquired personal jurisdiction over the defendant?
We didn't think we did.
Okay.
That's why technically...
So you just filed the lawsuit relying on that provision that you could serve him later? Or
no, we didn't know he was dead.
Well, but
how did you serve him?
You didn't serve him.
We didn't serve him. Well, so how did we found out he was dead?
You told the statute of limitations. That's...
You just filed the lawsuit and...
thinking that he was alive.
And in state court, I think you don't have to serve them until, what, 30 days or something like that?
There's actually no time.
No time.
We do get into this whole issue regarding, delay reduction orders and those kinds of things. But independent of that, there is no specific rule that addresses when you have to serve somebody. It's vice versa. If you serve somebody, you must file a case within 10 days.
Right, right.
But if you file a case, you can serve them 10 years later, technically, to keep the case alive if you don't know where they are, for example, and that would be Justice Hobbs' concern with respect to the person that's missing in action or the person that's missing on an outward bound trip. You file the case within the statute of limitations. If the person ends up being alive, you then go forward with when you find them. If it's a year later, 2 years later, 5 years later, or whatever, if the person you find out they or was then declared dead, that's an interesting issue. Does the death go back to the relation of when they disappeared? Or does it go back, or is it at the point in time in which the death occurred, and then you go to Rule 25, and I don't know the answer to that, but it's an...
Well, we don't have to go there today in any of them, do we? But I wanted to follow up. So you filed the case, and you just...
We tried to serve him.
Right.
Couldn't find him. It goes on for several months where we have to ask for continuances on the getting service because that court did have a delay reduction order. Eventually, we find out that he had died. In conclusion, our position is that these people have their right to have their claim heard on the merits, that the remedial revival statute was intended to cover a situation such as this, that it does not lead to an absurd result, and we ask the court to reverse Judge Davidson's opinion with respect to how it applies to the facts of this case, we leave it up to this court to decide whether it's now going to adopt the modern trend of capacity or not. That isn't something that we need to have done. Thank you very much.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank counsel for your arguments. Please stand submitted in the court.